Cardiff, Wales, just after New Year's 1943, was proving to be more exciting than Special Agent Fifi had anticipated. She'd come in expecting just another mission, coaxing secrets out of an unsuspecting British spy trainee, which it was at first. But now this poor man was quaking in his boots. She turned on all of her sweetness at full blast. She had to get him to calm down so that he could explain what had changed since their dinner last night. Finally, he started to talk. He had just come back from the police station. The police had come to check the papers of foreigners at his hotel, and he had been flagged because his leave papers were made out by the British authorities, but he was meant to be posing as a Norwegian. He was worried his cover had been blown, that he'd jeopardized the success of his final SOE test, and that, as a result, he might not get sent into the field. But as he spilled these fears, the young man paused, thinking for the first time, it seemed, about another way he might have ruined his mission. Fifi could see the wheels turning, until everything clicked into place. He stared at her, aghast, and even more devastated than he'd been a few minutes before. He hadn't just blown his cover with the Cardiff police. He'd done something much worse. He'd spilled every secret he had to this beautiful woman and shown just what a vulnerable agent he was. He wasn't alone. Special Agent Fifi was a master of her craft, of getting young agents to trust her, to talk to her, to tell her everything they knew. As the final safeguard between agents and the field, she had to make sure they were ready. Their lives depended on it. And so did the Allied war effort. This is Espionage, the Parcast original exploring the missions of the world's most incredible spies and what brought their covert operations into the public eye. Throughout this show, we'll explore real-world spy tactics required to impersonate, exploit, and infiltrate the most confidential places in the world. I'm Carter Roy. You can find all episodes of Espionage and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. To stream Espionage for free on Spotify, just open the app and type Espionage in the search bar. At Parcast, we're grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. This is our second episode on Marie-Christine Chilver, the British agent provocateur who tested new British spies during World War II. Known as Special Agent Fifi, the cunning, beautiful seductress was an expert at coaxing secrets out of unsuspecting targets. Last week, we covered Christine's background, her escape from a prison camp in France during the German occupation, and her stunning rise in Britain's newest spy agency, the Special Operations Executive, or SOE. This week, we'll follow Christine on her mission to weed out loose-lipped SOE agents and explore how her extraordinary skill made her a mysterious legend in the annals of espionage. It was December 1942, the height of World War II. The conflict raged across Europe, and England's newly formed intelligence organization, the Special Operations Executive, or SOE, needed to send more agents behind enemy lines. But before they sent new recruits into German-occupied zones, the SOE needed to train and test their students. First, there were the months spent learning sabotage and subversion methods. But then, every student faced a final test, a 96-hour training scheme. Well, during this exercise, students were given a mission by instructors, which always included a rendezvous with a contact. They were given a description of this contact and a specified time and location for the meetup. The only thing they weren't told was that their contact would never come. The real plan was for a striking 22-year-old blonde named Christine to find them instead. Her real name was Marie Christine Chilver, but these students would meet her under her SOE cover. To them, she was Christine Collard, a journalist from France. SOE officials, meanwhile, had to keep her identity hidden from the students, so they called her by yet another name, Special Agent Fifi. Fifi was new to the SOE, but she'd already started to prove her worth. She had a talent for getting trainees to trust her and spill their secrets, and in the process, helped identify the SOE's vulnerabilities. Fifi, meanwhile, was more than happy to do her part to help defeat the Nazis. She had suffered the impacts of the war firsthand. In Latvia, where the Russians seized her family's property, then again in France, when the Germans imprisoned her for her British citizenship. Had it not been for her escape, she'd still be there, starving and hopeless, or worse, dead. She was eager to be as useful as possible to the cause, and the SOE was just as eager to use her. On the night of December 30th, 1942, Agent Fifi arrived at the Victoria Hotel in Wolverhampton. She walked into the lounge around 7 p.m., searching for a Norwegian man with a strong build and a prominent nose. She glanced around the dimly lit room casually, but really, she was scanning the guests and tuning into their muffled conversations. Too old, too fat, too tall, wrong accent, wrong hair. Her eyes stopped on a lone man who seemed to be waiting for someone with that prominent nose. One way to find out if this was her mark. She walked up and asked, "Are you by any chance Tobias Skog?" The man seized, startled by the sound of his own name, especially coming from Fifi. He was expecting to meet a man, and the person standing in front of him was most certainly a woman. Suspicious, Skog tried to brush her off, but Fifi was ready for that. She smiled sweetly, then told him softly that she was sent to help. Skog hesitated, disarmed by the smile, the warm voice, and the appealing offer of help. His contact, after all, still hadn't shown. Perhaps this woman knew something. This was Fifi's opening. She sat down and reeled him in. She told him she knew all about the SOE, the school, the training, and the 96-hour schemes. How would she know so much if she wasn't part of his mission? Which, in fact, she was, but not in the way that she led Skog to believe. Her charming, clever chatter worked, despite the fact that she didn't have the crucial password or parole that Skog was meant to ask of his contact. Paroles, according to the International Spy Museum, allow intelligence personnel to recognize one another and establish trust. But even without the parole, Skog warmed to Fifi, let his guard down, and admitted that he was on his 96-hour scheme. He was relieved to finally have someone to talk to. And once he started talking, he didn't seem to want to stop. First, he told her about his mission, which was to form a railway sabotage resistance organization, about the contact he'd planned to meet tonight but hadn't found. Then, he ordered dinner for them both and talked on, answering Fifi's charming questions about his background. He described his escape route to England in April 1942 via Sweden, Russia, Persia, India, and Africa, his SOE training in Scotland. He even told her about his anticipated sabotage mission in Norway. Fifi was pleased that her tactics were working, but also disturbed at how easily they were working. These trainees ought to have the sense to evade her questions, to resist the appeal of her pretty face and half-baked intel on their missions. Then, Skog started to do just that. As dinner wound down, he seemed to realize that he was doing a whole lot of talking to a woman he couldn't be sure was on his side. His answers to Fifi's probes got vaguer, He sidestepped her questions about the Norwegian forces and where they were headquartered, despite her best efforts. Then, he tried to turn the conversation around and question Fifi. He demanded to know who she was and if she knew any of the SOE instructors' names. An interesting turn of events. Fifi took a mental note of when he got suspicious, so she could refine her method and improve the test. A good thing, though, on a broader scale. At least eventually he'd caught some sense. Still, his questions were far less subtle and charming than hers had been. She responded coolly with false information about her position with the school and the instructors. She followed this up with her reminder that she was there to provide him with help. Then she calmly rose and told him to telephone her the next day. But Fifi's phone never rang. Well, she'd failed her mission in the end. But as always, her failure was not all bad. It was good news for the SOE, or decent news anyway. Skog had leaked out plenty of information before he realized his folly. He'd passed her test, but not by much. She emphasized that as she wrote up her report that night, and then she caught the next train bound for Cardiff, where her next assignment was waiting. Gunnar Tingelstad, a lanky 29-year-old man, sat in the lounge of the Angel Hotel on New Year's Day 1943. He took a sip of his drink, waiting for a man whom he'd never met. He looked at the strange faces surrounding him, searching for features, but as the time ticked by, Tingelstad grew more anxious. Maybe his contact wasn't coming. Maybe he had gotten the wrong time. But then, around 6:45 p.m., Fifi arrived. Something about Fifi's friendly smile and demeanor immediately fooled Tingelstad. She seemed too sweet and innocent to be telling a lie. So, like Skog and so many others, he talked. About his 96-hour mission in Cardiff, about his home in Oslo, his politics, his family, his experiences during the war. Then Tingelstad told her the most interesting tidbit of all. He knew all about what had happened to other chaps on their 96-hour exercises. Fifi was alarmed. If the students were comparing notes about their security tests, it was only a matter of time before she would be the next topic of their conversations. And then what use would her test be? Still, for now, it was clearly working. As dinner came to a close, Tingelstad agreed to meet her for lunch the next day. But when Tingelstad arrived at the rendezvous, he was not in the same affable mood as the night before. He'd been at the police station, and he was worried that his cover was blown. Of course, he knew that this was likely all a part of his test. Local police may have collaborated with SOE during the students' 96-hour schemes to help prepare them for real interrogations in the field. They needed to make sure that the agents they sent out could maintain their cover story should they ever be caught by the enemy. But Tingelstad knew that even if it was an SOE-constructed test, it didn't mean there weren't real stakes. If he performed poorly, he might not be released into the field. All his months of training would be for nothing. He'd never be able to help the Allies. Perhaps it was thinking about the SOE's tricks that helped him realize the truth. Perhaps it was a tinge of pity in Fifi's expression. But suddenly he knew it was too late. He'd already failed the 96-hour mission, thanks to Fifi. Why he had told her everything, he couldn't say. He announced that he could kick himself for not having seen through the whole scheme immediately. Then he began running through all the events of their meeting, everything he'd said, every turn he'd taken that had landed him here. Fifi stayed silent as he spoke, cocking her head. She was interested in the way this young man was responding. He had failed her test. But he wasn't turning on her like Skog had. Instead, he was putting together the pieces of what had happened, of where he went wrong. It was a smart approach. The approach of a man who learned from his mistakes, something she always strived to do. Something that made a good agent. which was exactly what the SOE and the Allies needed. Fifi was intrigued and inspired. Perhaps it was time to reassess her test and start a new mission. Coming up, Fifi weighs her options, trying to determine what decisions will best impact the SOE and the Allied war effort. Now, back to the story. In January 1943, SOE student Gunnar Tingelstad foolishly revealed his entire mission to Special Agent Fifi at Cardiff's Angel Hotel. He believed she was part of his mission, but then he realized his mistake. And Fifi was intrigued by his methodical, learning-oriented approach to failure. She wanted to discuss the results of the test with this young man, not a part of her initial mission and a decision that came with its own risks. Revealing her role might lead to students hearing word of her part in the 96-hour tests, which, according to Tingelstad, they all recklessly discussed already. That would compromise the test itself. After all, she relied on surprise to draw in students. But on the other hand, if she told him, it could highlight the dangers of poor security and could help prevent him from making similar mistakes on his missions. And based on his apparently learning-oriented bent, it seemed a message worth sending. Plus, she was starting to have doubts about her test in general. After all, Tingelstad had technically failed, having told her everything he knew before finding her out, while her last trainee, Skog, had technically passed, having found her out before revealing some of his most crucial intel. But Tingelstad would make a better agent than Skog, she was sure. She decided to admit her role in the deception and emphasized to Tingelstad that she would make sure it didn't spell the end of his espionage career, if he'd commit to learning from this mistake. Meanwhile, Fifi had one more assignment on her slate with the test as it existed now. Fifi arrived in Newcastle on Sunday, January 10th, 1943, looking to contact a student operating under the name of John Carter. Carter was supposed to be in the large bar on the left of the main door of the Turk's Head between the hours 12:30 and 13:30. She was told he'd be carrying a Penguin novel. But things in Newcastle took an unexpected turn. At approximately 12:45 p.m., Fifi saw her mark. But he was not in the bar where he was supposed to be. He had gone to the right of the entrance instead of the left, entering the tap room, which had a strict men-only policy. Fifi hesitated at the door. She wondered if she should go inside. It might cause a scandal, drawing attention to her and Carter, but she needed to contact him, and the clock was ticking. Fifi took a deep breath and opened the door. As expected, all eyes followed her as she rushed over to her mark and asked if he was Mr. Carter. He was noticeably startled. He was expecting to meet a man at the bar. Fifi was clearly in the wrong place. But how did she know his name? He stammered and fidgeted, calling even more attention to Fifi's presence. Everyone in the bar stared, uneasy. Another patron at the bar started walking over. She needed to get her words out quickly. She pleaded with Carter and explained that she urgently needed to speak with him. The patron, meanwhile, walked up and asked her to leave. What could she do? She had to go. But as she went, she made a last plea, asking Carter to join her in the other bar, where he was supposed to meet his contact. He told her he'd prefer to stay put. Fifi was taken aback. He would prefer to stay put? And do what? She gave him some time to change his mind, but after waiting nearly 15 minutes, she concluded he had no intention of joining her. Fifi gave the waitress a note to deliver to Carter that once more requested he switch rooms. She looked into the tap room while it was delivered, but he completely ignored it. Then she tried to go back into the tap room, but she was refused entry. So she made a final effort. She watched the door, waiting for Carter to leave. But nearly an hour later, the waitress told her that he had left. He must have gone through the cloakroom. Fifi was frustrated. Yes, she'd failed her mission, and her target, it seemed, had passed his test, but only because of his complete lack of flexibility or even curiosity. If he had been in the field, he could have missed the opportunity to collect some valuable intelligence. And then there was the base problem, his inability to follow simple instructions between turning right or left into the tap room or bar. She'd be sure to note all of that in her report to the SOE on the mission. But it was also yet another sign that perhaps her test wasn't exactly testing for the right things. She also had another suspicion, though. Perhaps the SOE students had caught on to her tricks, and Carter had been warned about the beautiful blonde. Yet another reason to worry that her test was becoming not only faulty, but more or less useless. Luckily, she was about to get a whole new host of tools to improve the test and ensure that it was adequately preparing agents for the dangers of the field. On January 21st, Fifi's manager at the SOE, Flying Officer Cyril Miller, surprised Fifi with some news. He had been making arrangements to secure her a spot at the Beaulieu School, the SOE's finishing school for special agents located in England. Fifi was delighted. This was just the opportunity she needed to workshop her test and ensure that she wasn't only embarrassing recruits, but also helping the SOE send the best possible agents into the field. Fifi reported to the Beaulieu on February 1st and completed her 10-day course with flying colors. Her instructor noted how quick, enthusiastic, and well-informed she was and that she had a good imagination. He also spoke with her about several improvements she wanted to make to her test. First, she wanted more background on her marks before starting a mission to expedite the process of gaining his trust. After all, enemy agents would often have such intel on SOE agents. The spies should be prepared to face someone who knew everything about them. Second, Fifi wanted to improve her test by making it more flexible. She'd split her single test into three subtests and then select the appropriate one on each mission. Test 1 would be a test of general discretion, in which she would assess her mark's reactions to someone who appeared not to know him at all. Test 2 would be a test of an agent's resistance to provocation, most similar to the test she'd already been conducting. And Test 3 would also be a test of resistance to provocation, but with the introduction of more information, like the names of SOE instructors. These were bold suggestions from a young agent, and Fifi knew as much. But she'd already gained a significant amount of trust and respect in the SOE, thanks to her success with the original test and her sharp reports on her tests as well. So they adopted her suggestions. They'd give her biographical briefs on each mark and allow her to try different sorts of tests. Fifi was delighted. She was moving towards the perfect test. She could feel it. But as Fifi continued going on 96-hour schemes with more and more frequency, she found her flexible, tiered plans for her test were getting lost in the grind of exam after exam. Most often, the SOE and practical concerns shoehorned her test back into number 2, just what she'd been doing before. It would take one particularly disastrous exam on June 29, 1943, to convince her that her original updates to the test were simply not enough. She entered the lounge of the Grand Hotel Birmingham at 12:35 p.m. to make contact with a student named Russell. He walked into the lounge around 1:15 p.m. and ordered some coffee. But something was off. Fifi noticed he was carrying a copy of The Way to Win Wars instead of the timetable he was instructed to. Roland Phillips, an espionage historian, has explained that carrying the correct book, magazine, or other paper into a rendezvous is a classic means by which secret agents can identify one another. Fifi hesitated. Perhaps he wasn't Russell after all. If it was, he'd already made a poor showing. But after watching him for another 15 minutes, Fifi heard her target ask for a light and overheard his foreign accent. It had to be Russell, timetable or no. Time to proceed with the mission then. Fifi had the page boy call him over, and they met in the hall. She introduced herself as Captain Johnson's secretary and apologized for not recognizing him at first. She explained the captain had been summoned to Liverpool unexpectedly and she came in his place. She offered her help as a guide or interpreter and suggested that they go to her hotel to talk it over. But Russell didn't immediately react to her. He made small talk to bide his time. In the meantime, he was cautious with Fifi and refused to go with her to her hotel. Instead, they went to another hotel on Temple Street, where suddenly, Russell proceeded to grill Fifi. He asked her about her work, the address of her office in London, and wanted a description of Captain Johnson. Fifi performed flawlessly under pressure, but Russell still scrutinized her with a cunning smile. He finally said he was sure that she had forgotten part of Captain Johnson's message and that she might be of great help to him if only she mentioned the crucial matter. Fifi knew he was asking her for the password, which she didn't have. Coming up next, Fifi's mission goes awry, leaving her concerned about her test once again. Now, back to the story. June 29th, 1943. Agent Fifi was being grilled by SOE student Russell in Birmingham. He wanted to know who sent her, and he strongly suspected it wasn't Captain Johnson like Fifi claimed. But Fifi wasn't budging. She needed to turn the conversation back on her target. She was the one who was sent to gather information about him. And it worked for a time. Russell took her to the Queen's House Hotel, where he was staying. He told her he was a journalist on holiday in Birmingham, helping the Wings of Victory campaign by selling painted silk scarves. He didn't seem the type to have an occupation like this, Fifi thought. His cover was completely unbelievable. Another dead giveaway was that he kept giggling while explaining his story. It seemed like he wasn't even trying to keep up the ruse. Why? But the mission only got stranger. Russell asked Fifi to do some hemming for him. Did he think this was all a joke? The incessant giggle certainly seemed to suggest so, and it was getting on Fifi's nerves, too. At about 4:30 p.m., they left the Queen's House Hotel and returned to town. They stopped and had tea in Temple Street, where Russell told Fifi that the little game they were playing was intensely amusing. Fifi was appalled and furious. Clearly, Russell had no idea what the stakes of this test were. His life, for one. The success of the Allied war effort, for another. She was extremely suspicious that the students were gossiping about her test and he'd expected her. But even so, his behavior was unacceptable. She had to get a handle on this, improve the test, and keep her mission useful. So she went to the SOE with two new requests. First, she wanted to attend the postmortems on the 96-hour exercises with her targets and their instructors. And second, she proposed that the test require the student to attend lunch with their intended contact. At this lunch, Fifi would be introduced to them. Once she had gained a little trust from her prey, the other agent would make an excuse and depart, leaving the student in Fifi's hands. This seemed like a logical plan. Attending the postmortem would give her insight into the student's perspective on the test, and even if the students did know about her, changing up the test with a luncheon would hopefully confuse them. The SOE saw her logic and accepted her suggestions. On Monday, August 16th, she set out for her next assignment in Bristol to test the new method. At 1 p.m. on Tuesday, August 17th, Fifi arrived at the Grand Hotel Bar. There, she found Mr. Morris, her manager, with a student named Morton. Mr. Morris introduced the pair and invited Fifi to join them. So far, so good. At lunch, Morton was talkative and sociable. Fifi explained the purpose of her stay at Bristol and dropped a hint about being free for the day. Morton casually mentioned a roadside inn which he had discovered the day before, providing Mr. Morris with a natural opportunity to suggest that they have tea there in the afternoon. Fifi quickly agreed, perhaps too quickly. But Fifi didn't think Morton caught on to this nuance. After lunch, Mr. Morris made his excuses and left. Morton and Fifi continued talking over coffee and then moved into the lounge. He was a natural conversationalist, but Fifi noticed that after several hours of chatting and telling dirty jokes, apparently a hobby of his, she had learned absolutely nothing about him that was of any consequence. Perhaps he had noticed how eager she was to spend the afternoon with him. Between 3 and 4 p.m., they left the Grand and took a bus to Westbury Hill, where they spent the afternoon at the Mulberry Tree Inn. They sat in the inn garden for several hours and walked to Blaise Castle. Morton was still chatting away, talking politics, chuckling over his dirty stories, and of course, talking about women with considerable gusto. Fifi was convinced. This non-stop talk was a tactic. Morton wasn't just talking. He was learning about Fifi without her having to say a word, by studying her reactions to every joke or comment. And in the process, as hard as she tried to soften him, he revealed absolutely nothing about himself. His gift of gab was his strength, and it was starting to wear Fifi out. After spending the afternoon at Westbury Hill, they returned to town and dined at the Grand. They had coffee, then drinks, and after 6 hours, Fifi finally threw in the towel. Morton had proven to be a formidable foe. So Fifi would give him the courtesy she'd given other talented trainees. She admitted their meeting wasn't a chance encounter. She told him she had been sent to check on him and the exercise. Morton clearly had seen through it from the beginning. What had tipped him off? His answer made her laugh. Mr. Morris's mustache twitched. But she asked him for more criticism, specifically about her own performance. Maybe she was too obvious, or perhaps the situation seemed unbelievable. He admitted that her eagerness to continue on with him was a little surprising, but Morton was too tactful to offer any other criticism. Well, Fifi was frustrated by the whole affair. She'd been sent to find out Morton's secrets, and instead, he spent the whole day observing her. Her new method for testing students was a disappointment. It seemed that every effort she made to improve their test wasn't working, likely because of one fundamental flaw. By now, the SOE students knew she'd be waiting for them. Around August 26th, an unsigned report in Fifi's file documented a conversation she had with Miller regarding the value of the 96-hour schemes. She argued that without being in enemy-occupied territory and having no tight corners to get out of, the point of the exercises was lost on students. She also expressed her concern that most of these students seemed to know what to expect during the exercises, including their interrogations. Still, even now, she wasn't ready to give up hope on her mission. She suggested that an entirely new system, containing what she called a series of jolts, replace their current setup. The SOE, meanwhile, tried to make its own improvement to the test. They arranged a more convincing cover for Fifi as a British journalist on the staff of the publication Housewife. But what happened next isn't entirely clear. This is where Fifi begins to slip from on-the-record agent to legend. Her file leaves a marked gap between November 1943 and March 1944. Perhaps during those months she was writing articles for Housewife or continuing her work on 96-hour schemes. Author Bernard O'Connor presents another possible explanation in his book, Agent Fifi and the Wartime Honeytrap Spies. Fifi may have been helping Miller and the Bayswater Interrogation Center, known as BSS, which was being used to interrogate SOE agents once they returned from the field. Her fluency in German, combined with her knowledge of SOE training, would certainly have been helpful questioning these agents. When Fifi's file picked up again after this gap, it painted a picture of where the SOE's next sites were. The end of the war. On June 6th, the Allies landed in Normandy and began the liberation of occupied France. Throughout the summer and early fall, victories all across the Western Front were pushing out German forces. It was just a matter of time now before the SOE would be disbanded. Plans were being made to absorb their skills into other British intelligence organizations, including plans for Fifi. By November 1944, Miller made arrangements with Air Commander Archibald Boyle, head of the SOE Intelligence and Security Directorate, for Fifi to receive training in wireless telegraphy. A wireless telegraphy is the transmission of telegraph signals by radio waves. The World War II intelligence community relied on the technology heavily, using it to send, receive, and intercept coded messages. Like the many students she tested, as part of her studies, Fifi was sent on her own training scheme. And after 19 days of Morse code and procedure instruction, and 17 hours of technical lectures, she completed her training on April 13, 1945. Her instructors gave her high marks and reported that she worked very well and made good contacts. Boyle seems to have agreed with Miller that upon completion of her training, Fifi should be given a position in Germany to utilize this training. And so, in May of 1945, Special Agent Fifi received new identification documents under her real name, Marie-Christine Chilver. Her undercover work with the SOE had officially come to an end. Information regarding Christine's post-war work in Germany has yet to surface. But the final document in her SOE file is a letter dated August 28, 1945. The letter is to the Control Commissions for Germany and Austria and gives a personal recommendation for Christine, saying she is trustworthy and reliable and is in every way suitable for employment of a confidential nature. What exactly this confidential position was is left to the imagination. But what is clear is that over the course of World War II, SOE's successes in subverting the Axis powers helped turn the tide of the war. And the lessons those agents learned from Fifi, despite her never quite perfect tests, helped them live to tell the tale. Fifi, or Marie-Christine Chilver, as she became known once more after the war, never revealed information about her work with the SOE. For over half a century, rumors of Agent Fifi, the gorgeous seductress who lured secrets from new recruits, spread. Many dismissed the tales as fiction, perhaps reluctant to believe that a female spy could have had quite the success rate of Agent Fifi. Others embraced the fantasy, reveling in the mystery of the beautiful blonde who'd get you to tell her anything. It wasn't until Fifi's file was declassified in 2014 that the world would uncover the truth behind her work and find out just how real, how dedicated, and how crucial to SOE operations she was. Thank you for listening to Espionage. We'll be back Friday with a new episode. For more information on Agent Fifi, amongst the many sources we used, we found Agent Fifi and the Wartime Honeytrap Spies by Bernard O'Connor extremely helpful to our research. You can find more episodes of Espionage and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify. Not only does Spotify already have all of your favorite music, but now Spotify is making it easier for you to enjoy all of your favorite Parcast originals, like Espionage, for free from your phone, desktop, or smart speaker. To stream Espionage on Spotify, just open the app and type Espionage in the search bar. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll be back next week with another deep dive into the world of clandestine operation. Espionage was created by Max Cutler and is a Parcast Studios original. Executive producers include Max and Ron Cutler. Sound design by Anthony Valsic, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Carly Madden, Isabella Way, and Joel Stein. This episode of Espionage was written by Angela Herer, with writing assistance by Kate Gallagher. I'm Carter Roy.